This is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull, in for Ben Kiefer. Post-traumatic stress disorder is usually associated with soldiers in combat. PTSD got a lot of attention this past week as the Department of Veterans Affairs made it easier for veterans to receive benefits after they're diagnosed with a disorder. But soldiers aren't the only ones who suffer from PTSD. Police officers, firefighters, other emergency personnel, and first responders are also likely to suffer from PTSD. Today on The Exchange, we'll speak with the author of Cop Shock about police officers and post-traumatic stress disorder. Also joining us will be an Iowa mental health counselor and an Iowa man who teaches first responders how to deal with stress. That's coming up on The Exchange right after this check of news from NPR. This is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull, in for Ben Kiefer. Post-traumatic stress disorder is an anxiety disorder that can develop after exposure to a terrifying event or ordeal in which grave physical harm occurred or was threatened. Now, most of the time, that's associated with soldiers in combat, and recent relaxing of the restrictions on getting PTSD treatment from the VA this past week garnered a fair amount of news. But first responders, police officers, firefighters, medical personnel, can be just as susceptible to PTSD. This hour, we'll be talking about PTSD in police officers, firefighters, other first responders. Joining us to start off the show is Alan Cates. He's the author of Cop Shock, Surviving Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, and joins us on the line from Arizona. Alan, welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you for inviting me.
So what was the impetus for writing this book for you?
I've known a lot of police officers throughout my life, and I even wasn't sure whether they had PTSD or developed PTSD on the same level as troops. And I started off by interviewing some police officers at the Los Angeles Police Department. And their counseling unit convinced me that they indeed did have a high level of PTSD. And through my research, I've discovered that it could be as high as a third of police officers in this country are afflicted with symptoms of PTSD. That doesn't mean that they have full-blown PTSD, but many of them show the symptoms.
Now, you mentioned the interviews that you had, and one of the things about your book is the number of personal stories and people talking about the incidents that led to their PTSD. We'd like you to read one of them. It's on page 192 of your book.
This is from a chapter I titled Flashbacks, and this is a story of Detective Bill Martin, who was with the Los Angeles Police Department. And so I'll just read this excerpt, which has been edited a bit to make it more palatable for the radio public. The reason why I'm saying that is that there is some profanity used, and this profanity comes from some of the police officers, and it is natural for them to speak in that way. Anyway, here's the excerpt. It was September 21st, 1980, a Sunday, a day whose anniversary reminds him there is no bottom to despair. He'd been a detective for 8 years, most of it in death investigations. It was a routine call, another dead baby run. He groaned himself into the seat, threw the car in gear, and braked. What's the hurry? He thought. The kid's not going anywhere. Bill hadn't slept well the night before or for many nights before that. He was always in a cold sweat and wasn't eating a lot these days. He snapped open the lock on the glove compartment, pulled out a flask, and drank deeply. He popped half a dozen antacids for the slow stomach burn he couldn't control and rolled out onto Los Angeles Street. He did 2 to 3 bodies a day, maybe 1,000 during his career. Stinkers, floaters, accidentals, industrials, overdoses, suicides, naturals. A lot of bodies. Bill had gone to his boss at detective headquarters and implored him to change his assignment. His boss said experienced detectives were hard to find. He suggested Bill take the day off and then get back in the trenches. Bill needed more than a day off. He needed the rest of his life off. Bill sneaked a quart of whiskey every day. He relieved the pain across his chest by taking 25 milligrams every 4 to 6 hours of Thorazine, a powerful antipsychotic drug that can have a sedating effect. He didn't link his drinking or drugging to the images of corpses swirling in and out of his brain. Even if I had made the connection, I would have denied it, he said. Bill used the pills in the daytime so he wouldn't smell of alcohol around fellow officers and civilians he met on crime scenes. Major bar time was after work, 6 to 8 double martinis at a stretch, then more at home where it was cheaper and more plentiful. Bill got loaded for a lot of reasons, any reason really. He would dream about the bodies, all of them, and there were hundreds.
Now, Alan Cates reading from his book, Cop Shock, Surviving Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder. Now, Alan, there are many stories like that. There are some common themes through them. And was it difficult for you to listen to all of these stories from these police officers?
I interviewed about 200 police officers who had been diagnosed with PTSD and had been seeing therapists. And yes, it was difficult. I can say of that 200, probably every one of them cried during the interview because it was so difficult for them to get the feelings out. And I think also the tears were from relief that they were able to talk to someone because cops generally don't talk to each other about such things as feelings. There was only one time when I actually lost it, and that was when I was speaking with an officer in New York. And I think it was probably just an accumulation of having interviewed so many officers over several days, and I had to excuse myself. I went into the bathroom, and I wept into a towel. And I came back a few minutes later and just resumed. After all, we're all journalists, and we're not supposed to have feelings either, right? But we do.
That's what I've been told.
Yeah.
Also joining us on the show, we'd like to welcome Dee Paddock, who is a licensed mental health counselor who joins us from our Des Moines studio. Good afternoon, Dee.
Good afternoon.
Can you give us a technical description of what PTSD is?
I'd rather give you probably a more useful description of what PTSD is, which for my clients is a traumatic experience or an accumulation of traumatic experiences that have happened in the past, but that the body is reliving as though those things are happening in the present. People with PTSD, as Bessel van der Kolk says, get lost in time, and sounds, memories, images, smells, anything can trigger a person back to a previous trauma, and their behaviors will exhibit that they are reliving that experience in the present, which obviously makes present-day life quite painful and often unbearable.
And is there any difference in the kinds of PTSD that somebody has depending on their experience? Is a soldier's PTSD any different than a police officer's PTSD that could be different than just an average person who was caught in a traumatic situation's PTSD?
That's a good question. What's interesting and what I find in my practice is that it's not so much which profession experienced which kind of trauma, but the defining meaning seems to be how much physical helplessness did that person experience in that moment of trauma. The more physically helpless a person is, the more they realize that they are unable to stave off the inevitable, terror, violence, death, whatever that fear is, that seems to be much more definitive in terms of how full-blown PTSD will or will not be.
Alan Cates, you wrote this book, and there's not a lot of literature out there about PTSD in first responders and police officers. There's a lot on soldiers, though. Do you think is it a culture issue and just talking about not just PTSD, but how that goes into the culture of being a police officer that was at the core of your interest in your research here?
I think so. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people have heard of the wall of silence, or even called the blue wall of silence. And this is, you know, police officers just don't like to discuss emotions. And they actually have a fairly, what I think is a valid reason for it. They feel that because they work with partners, if their partner is talking about how they're feeling about certain things, they start to feel uneasy and they question whether that partner will come to their rescue if they're in a difficult situation. Or they wonder how that their partner, is my partner having emotional problems? If we go to a bloody crime scene, how is he going to react or how is she going to respond? So they do have some legitimate claims, but what they need is an atmosphere where they feel it's confidential and they can say how they feel, but it has to be at the appropriate time in an appropriate place with an appropriate person, like a peer support person or a therapist.
And Dee Paddock, your clients include police officers. How much of the time that you work with them is spent just addressing some of the issues of the culture among police officers as much as the PTSD itself?
Oh, I think that's a very important point that you and Alan make. I happen to be married to a police captain, and so I think from the beginning when I'm working with a first responder or someone in law enforcement, I have some understanding of that culture of silence that you've referred to. And law enforcement and first responders need to make sure that you get it and that there's not going to be judgment around why they maybe haven't dealt with it, you know, until now, or why they never shared these stories with their spouse. And so establishing that rapport and that trust with people who very often distrust, you know, the media and the public to sort of portray them in a bad light, I think that's a very important part of the therapy that I do with first responders.
As we mentioned earlier in the show, the Veterans Administration has just made it easier for veterans with PTSD to get help or treatment. And I don't know if Dee or Alan, you'd like to take this, but are there still barriers for police officers and first responders to get the help they need for PTSD?
Absolutely. About 54% of police departments in the United States have peer support units. But that means that really the majority, the majority of small departments do not have any kind of peer support. And I get calls all the time from police officers and from lawyers who are conducting lawsuits against departments, because the departments often just stick their heads in the sand and they say, well, this is not happening and we don't deal with stress. And if you've got, if you've been diagnosed with PTSD, then you're out of here. And, you know, I don't say that frivolously. I mean, lately I've been involved in a case where a police officer was fired because he has PTSD, even though he's being treated for it. The department just said, the chief said, well, we can't have anybody with PTSD here, so you're out.
Well, and those are certainly some of the issues that we'll get to in just a moment. We're going to take a short break here on The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. We're talking about post-traumatic stress disorder. Our guests are Alan Cates, the author of Cop Shock, Surviving Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, and we're also talking to Dee Paddock, a licensed health counselor in Des Moines who has worked with officers. We'll have more from both of them and your calls and emails as The Exchange continues on Iowa. This is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan All in for Ben Kiefer. We're talking about post-traumatic stress disorder among police officers, firefighters, first responders. If you have a story to tell, let us know about it. 866-780-9100. You can email us at theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. You can also send us a tweet on Twitter at IPR Talk. Our guests are Alan Cates. He's the author of Cop Shock, Surviving Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, and Dee Paddock, a licensed mental health counselor from Des Moines. And Dee, right before the break, we were talking about barriers to getting help for PTSD. What's your take on that?
Are you talking to Dee?
Dee, yeah. Did we lose?
I think there are huge barriers to getting treatment. And one of them that I see as a therapist is that unless there are visible physical injuries, most people with post-traumatic stress or post-traumatic stress disorder are likely to be, not believed by their employer, by friends and family members, and they're often dismissed, you know, in terms of, well, you survived, or at least you lived through it, all of which pushes especially law enforcement and first responders sort of, you know, back into hiding what's going on for them and thinking, if other people don't think this is a problem, then I must be going crazy. And that's obviously something people want to keep a secret.
Dee, what treatments are most successful with PTSD?
You know, the literature shows that PTSD, especially full-blown PTSD, can be extremely treatment-resistant, which I think is why, you know, police departments may have the wrong idea that an officer needs to be dismissed if he or she has that diagnosis. But what we've realized is that for a long time, we thought that PTSD was a mind problem. It was how you were thinking about the trauma. And what we now know and what the research clearly supports is that post-traumatic stress disorder is a mind, body, and spirit problem, that it affects people cognitively, physiologically, and emotionally. So traditional talk therapy certainly has its place in treating PTSD. It's how we build a relationship with a client. It's how we build rapport and trust and allow someone to tell their trauma story. But if we stop there, then we have only addressed the mind portion of PTSD. And so body-oriented therapies like EMDR, which has
now been...
EMDR is eye movement, desensitization, and reprocessing. And it is an exposure therapy that helps a client confront in a safe and therapeutic way their traumatic memories in an embodied kind of an experience. And the Veterans Association, the U.S. Department of Defense, the American Psychological Association, and the American Psychiatric Association have all now said that EMDR is an evidence-based, effective treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder. And it can be really useful for clients in addition to, you know, talk therapy, which we normally do in a therapy setting.
Alan, in your research, did you find that that there is success in treating PTSD and the bigger issue is just getting the help available to officers?
I mean, it's important to try to get the help to them. And even if you provide the help, doesn't mean officers are going to go because they are afraid of the confidentiality issue, that the department will find out, and that they might lose their pension. But I have to agree with Dee. Anecdotally, I've heard from many officers who talk about EMDR therapy, and it's been very effective for them. Some of them have to have it repeated, but cost-wise, it's a lot cheaper than any other kind of therapy, and that's for all you police chiefs out there who are thinking, how am I going to deal with this with the department's budget? And it's very effective, and police officers seem to really like it.
Is there any preventive measures that can be because if you're in a profession like police or fire or an EMT or something like that, where you know there is a probability that you're going to be in a position that could cause PTSD, is there anything preventive that can be done?
I think it's really important that police officers set up their own support system before something happens, so that they know that if something happens, that they will have to talk to somebody, and they have to identify who will that person be, or maybe it'll be several people. It could be a spouse, but it would probably be better if it was someone who was like a peer support officer or somebody in the clergy. A lot of clergy today are trained in dealing with people who have had severe traumatic experiences. The important thing is that police officers have to talk. I know that sounds really simple, but cops don't talk. They don't talk to each other. They don't talk to their spouses. And they don't want to give an image of themselves that is beyond the macho guy or gal where bullets bounce off their chest.
Let's go to the phones. Matt in Iowa City is on the line. Matt, welcome to The Exchange.
Hi there.
You have a story for us.
Yeah, I don't know how to really explain it, but I'm a teacher actually in California, and I'm an art teacher, and I have about 30 students in one class, and one of those students out of the 30, he was diagnosed with PTSD for emotional problems, and basically he's allowed to leave my room without discussing with me or telling me that he has a problem and he can just jet, or, and I just think it's strange that now it's, I don't know if it's coming to that or what, but that's basically my comment.
Matt, what age is this student?
This is high school.
This is high school. Matt, thank you very much for your call. Dean, this might be a good question for you. There are definitely some people who still don't completely understand PTSD or may try to apply it in other situations. Is that part of the stumbling block to get the right treatment to the right people at the right time?
Oh, I definitely think so. And Matt's question is an important one, because the DSM-4, which for us therapists is the diagnostic Bible and the diagnoses that insurance companies require for reimbursement, at this time, children, and that would include adolescents, are not included in the criteria that makes it possible for an actual PTSD diagnosis. However, I have worked with many, many children and adolescents who meet the criteria for PTSD. And so as a teacher, I can see that Matt is not only dealing with something that teachers are probably poorly prepared to confront in their classrooms, but it's also a very gray area for therapists who try to make the argument that a child exposed to severe child abuse or neglect, sexual abuse, any of those things can show the same range of problems that we see in adults. And they haven't even, children and adolescents obviously have even less ability and knowledge to deal with what's going on for them.
PTSD is often diagnosed as other disorders. It can be misdiagnosed as just anxiety or depression, even though those could be symptoms of PTSD. How common is a misdiagnosis when it comes to PTSD?
That's a good question, too, because what we know is that there is something called comorbidity, which means in, you know, therapeutic jargon, that PTSD very often coexists with depression, generalized anxiety disorder, or panic disorder. And so a therapist can be confronted with a range of behaviors and problems that meet many of the criteria for all four of those diagnoses. And culturally, I think we're getting better, as you said, and this week has helped, but we're more likely to be comfortable with a police officer or a first responder saying, I was diagnosed with anxiety, I was diagnosed with depression, rather than I was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, which just sounds more alarming, even though depression, anxiety, and panic can be extremely debilitating for people.
Now, Alan, in your book, it seems like many of the stories, people who suffer from PTSD, anxiety and depression are symptoms and might be the things that really end up affecting their personal and professional lives.
That's true, but I think that we have to be a little clearer. I mean, PTSD is categorized as an anxiety disorder. Then there are various other symptoms, like depression, for example, which is not really a symptom of PTSD. It can coexist with it, as Dee was pointing out. Depression can become a result of PTSD because it's so hard to deal with the symptoms, or it can be, you know, a precondition.
And we're going to have to pick up that after a quick newscast. You're listening to The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. More on PTSD and police officers after the news. This is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull, in for Ben Kiefer. This hour, we're talking about post-traumatic stress disorder, specifically how it affects police officers, firefighters, and other first responders. Our guests include Alan Cates, the author of Cop Shock, Surviving Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, and Dee Paddock, a licensed mental health counselor from Des Moines. We want to start this half hour with a phone call. Charlie from Des Moines is on the line. Charlie, welcome to The Exchange.
Hello. My experience with post-traumatic stress disorder started with my father, who was in two of the worst battles, World War II, the Battle of Leyte and the Battle of Manila. He handled it really well, but the way he did was he blocked it out. And basically, I've been exploring this for many years, and the thing that I found out from the soldiers is if your friend dies in battle and you're mourning his death, you're more vulnerable to being killed yourself. But what I found out through all my experience with it is that it also applies to everyone. Trauma and loss occurs to everyone, and what post-traumatic stress disorder actually is referring to is the inability to release the pain and emotion related to the trauma. And the difficult part about that is a lot of people don't identify with what you experience and can't imagine why you're upset. The other aspect is, for anyone that's experienced it, you already lived through it once. If you can do EMDR, which I have done myself, you can actually release the energy of the emotion from the thoughts, which are the memories, and once you stop talking about it, once it doesn't come up, it's gone, it's cured. It's a finite event. It occurred once in the past. Yeah, I hope I'm summarizing as much as I can for your show, but that's this.
Well, thank you very much. Alan D., what do you make of Charlie's call there?
Well, I think that he is absolutely right that if you get the appropriate treatment, and for some people that will be EMDR, which, you know, requires a reprocessing of a traumatic memory that's gotten stuck. Trauma causes problems in how we store memory and how we take in information. And traumatic memories tend to get stored in nonverbal places in our brain. And we're not exactly sure why, but EMDR does help connect those nonverbal images, smells, sounds, memories to be connected to the left part of our brain, which connects us with language and the ability to make meaning out of an experience. And I do see in clients that after an appropriate number of EMDR sessions, they are able to say, that happened then, and this is now. And it's, I don't believe it's that the memory is gone, but it has been reprocessed and integrated in a more healthy and appropriate way.
We're now going to have joined the show Bob Montserrat. He's the Federal Disaster Mortuary Operational Response Team member. He also works in disaster situations and has done training on PTSD issues. Bob, welcome to the show.
Yes, I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
You speak a little bit about what actually it is you do both in disaster situations and then the experience you've had in working with people that are exposed to PTSD.
Well, first of all, I work for the state of Iowa. I work in the Division of Criminal Investigation Crime Laboratory, and I've been there for 31 years. And I've worked homicide investigations for probably 11 years while I've been there. So that is my primary work, and I also work for the Disaster Mortuary Operational Response Team, which is called DMORT, which is a federal response team, and we go out on major disasters. So I have been out on personal crime scenes and disasters like the World Trade Center, Hurricane Katrina, several different air crashes, the air crash in Sioux City in 1989, and personally experienced the stress associated with those events. So I have some firsthand knowledge of what I went through, which has been a great help when I deal with other people. So on the DMORT team, I have dual roles. I either work in the morgue if they need me there, or I'm their mental health person and deal with people as they express themselves and the things that they're feeling or experiencing at the scene itself. So I do that, and I'll also work with people after the scene.
And what do you see an increase in PTSD among people who are in the emergency response area?
I would say that I'm not experiencing an increase in that, and I think it's because people are aware of the fact that we experience stressful situations and that we could react to it in negative ways. I think there's been a big push over the last few years to make people aware that there is help out there, that they may experience these things, and when they experience these traumatic events, a lot of the reactions that they experience are normal reactions to abnormal events. So I think in that sense it's better, though I have to express that I have experienced and met people that have experienced and living through PTSD.
And Bob, with your knowledge of PTSD and your exposure to these, do you deal with any of those kinds of issues?
Generally, I'm not dealing with the people that are experiencing or have the PTSD. I'm usually, what I'd like to say is I go in early intervention before it gets to PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
So when it's a critical incident, I like to go in there. I consider what I do first aid, as opposed to treating PTSD, which is more surgery. So first aid versus surgery. So my goal is to try to intercede and deal with people to prevent the PTSD down the road.
And what do you do?
Well, when I'm out on disaster, if I'm out on a large scale, for instance, 9/11 or Katrina, I usually do one-on-one work with individuals to see where they are, what they're experiencing, and I try to deal with every one of the emergency workers. So primarily I'm working with emergency workers that are dealing with the effects after an event. Now, with New York, it was a lot different because I was dealing with the police and firefighters that were there at the time, and then some of the people, the citizenry, so that was a little different because I was dealing with some citizens, too. And then I was dealing with people that went to respond to help. And it's amazing how people are traumatized just going out to help. So every disaster that I go to, many of the responders that are there to help people are also traumatized.
But when you're talking to people, if I'm in the, you know, one of the people who are responding, and I've been part of this traumatic situation, and I may be at the early exposures to PTSD, what do you do with me to help me get through this?
Well, first of all, many times people are not looking for help. They're being impacted, not understanding why they're feeling the way they feel. So for me, it's an observation. I try to look for people that, to me, are obviously stressed at the scene, the way they're acting, the way they're talking, what they are doing. And when that happens, then I will go and confront the person, not in a way that is to scare them away, but to befriend them and see, you know, what's going on in their life. And so I have questions that I'll ask them that, have you been sleeping? Are you having difficulty sleeping? You know, what's going on in your life at this point? What's happening? And many times, and a lot of people that I work with know me. So they know, you know, that they don't have to be afraid of me and they don't have to be afraid to open up. So in this sense, then they'll tell me, well, you know, I saw that little child there that was dead, and that really, really bothered me because I thought about my own kids and I thought about what the parents are going through. So when a person starts to talk, then we can start to deal with what they're experiencing at that time and what they're feeling at that time.
Do you work with clients that would have benefited from someone like Bob and would have significantly, in your opinion, diminished the effects of PTSD on them?
I think if there was an early intervention, I think it makes a difference.
Yeah, what's your take on that?
You know, I agree. When I think about really effective treatment for PTSD, I think of both parts, that if people who are first responders to a disaster can have someone like Bob who is aware of the stress level, who has experienced it himself, if there can be that person dealing with the immediate effects of being overwhelmed by the sensory and body experience of what they're witnessing or what's happened to them, that's the first critical piece. And yes, if I had clients coming for what I think is the second piece of treatment, which, you know, he said he's the first aid, and then we send them to the surgeon, people needing both, I think it would be very helpful because we aren't starting from the very beginning of just giving people permission to talk about what happened. That's already happened in the critical incident debriefing.
I have a question, and I'd like all three of you to start to comment, but I'd like to start with Alan Cates. Alan, do you think that some professions, like including police work, are just stressful by nature, and that PTSD is just an occupational hazard, that at some level it's inevitable and we just need to have people be aware of it and know how to treat it when it happens?
That's a very tricky question because, police work by its nature, of course, is stressful.
And yes, they will experience traumatic events. But I think what we have to be aware of, and especially for the listeners to this program, is that when we have conversations like this, I think everybody gets the impression that, oh, you have a traumatic event, or you're going to get PTSD. That's not the case. Most people do not get PTSD. Most people deal with things very well. And as a matter of fact, some people actually thrive as a result of a traumatic experience. I'm not suggesting they should go out and have one, but just so that they can test themselves. But it is a fact that there's something called, you know, post-traumatic growth, where people do find ways to actually find some kind of meaning in the traumatic event. So I think we've got to be real careful in what we're saying so that we don't give the impression that everybody gets PTSD. It's not the case.
But is there anything that we can do in terms of the way that we structure law enforcement or firefighters or first responders that can help mitigate this? Or is it, I mean, not inevitable that everyone's going to get it, but inevitable that it exists and that some are going to get it and there's not much we can do to change that?
Well, I think that there are some things that we can do. For example, discussions today tend to trend toward resiliency. We have our own built-in natural kind of resiliency, but resiliency can be learned. There are various techniques that you can learn to get yourself through a traumatic event. And if you're a cop and you know sooner or later you're going to have a traumatic event, then there are things that you can do so that you can, you know, find meaning in the event or cope with the event or prepare yourself for the event.
Bob, when your teams mobilize, is there any effort to do what Alan's just describing, where there's some kind of things like, hey, guys, you're going to see some crazy stuff, and here's how you can help deal with it? Is that part of the system?
Absolutely. I agree with Alan. Not everybody gets post-traumatic stress disorder. It is a low amount of people compared to the many people at work. And, yes, we do pre-incident training. We do put on training for our people, for officers. I teach at the academy here in Iowa, and I put on a stress management training class. And so we do pre-training. We warn them about what could happen and how they might feel and what they might experience, and normalize those feelings before they go in there cold and experience something, and it's a shock to their system. So pre-incident training is something that is essential, in my opinion.
Are psychological services for PTSD covered under the insurance that most policemen receive in their benefits, in your experience?
You know, it's getting better. And as I said earlier, as treatments like EMDR, which, you know, at one time were considered sort of fringe kinds of treatments, as they become an accepted part of practice, insurance companies are being forced to follow along, because not only is it being used more, but there's really good research, evidence-based research, that supports the effectiveness of those kinds of treatments. And I wanted to add that I agree with Alan and with Bob that by no means is PTSD an inevitable result of working in law enforcement or being a first responder. As a therapist, I want to add that one of the things I think we can do is help those people, you know, as they come into a job, to assess their own risk factors, because we know that early childhood trauma can put you more at risk for developing PTSD later if you're exposed to traumatic events. We know that cumulative trauma, if we have an officer who has experienced cumulative major trauma, that officer may be more at risk to develop PTSD. And I think assessing your own risk factors gives you one of the most important things that you need in treating PTSD, which is a sense of control, a sense of having control over your own body, your own reactions, and knowing what to expect.
You're talking about a self-assessment. Is there any concern, though, that if the hiring of people for these And obviously, there's a lot of psychological testing that goes into, you know, being a police officer, some of these other professions. But is there, because this kind of plays into what we've been talking about here, is that a fear that if your employer knows that you're predisposed to PTSD, you might not get that great assignment, you might not get that promotion, and then that feeds the whole culture of these first responders that they are insulated and tough and macho. Is there any concern about that out there? And anyone?
Oh, I think so. I mean, as a therapist, I have concerns. I think that I am imagining this, you know, self-assessment, if you will, as part of education and training that would be ongoing for officers, for first responders, so that they can do that in the anonymity and safety of a group training experience, not as part of a hiring or psychological evaluation.
Yeah, I agree with Dee. That's very tricky. I don't think too many officers are going to want to have any kind of a pre-screening like that because it could label them. But I'll give you an idea of just how far some of this goes. It's, some officers, they don't want to be labeled with PTSD, so they will, you know, tell a peer support person or a therapist tied to the administration that they have some alcohol problems, and alcohol is a legitimate concern where, you know, as Bill Martin said, one of the detective who I quoted at the beginning of the program, he said, just about all cops are drunks, which is not true, but it has a very high rate, about 25% in a lot of jurisdictions. Well, so the point I'm saying is a lot of cops will tell them, okay, I'm an alcoholic, but really they're not, and they have trouble with PTSD, but when they get to a treatment clinic or to a therapist, everything is confidential. When they're outside the department, and they'll get their treatment for PTSD, but they won't get the label. The department won't find out about it. And that's, yes, it's deceptive, but this is, you know, this is reality.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is Bob. And I know that for officers, there's resistance to going in for treatment or to seek help because they feel like it could be a matter of their job, and they don't want to take that risk. And then you also mentioned the fact of, you know, people look up to people in law enforcement or people that do disaster work and look at them as macho, tough people. One of the things that I always teach is that, you know, people put on a front, they put on an act, because in law enforcement you have to have control of situations. You have to be in control of situations, so you have to do that. But deep down, people in law enforcement and people in the emergency services are compassionate, kind people that care about others. And that's a big motivation for what they do. And so because we're like that, because we have that feeling of wanting to help, to be there to help people, then you're more susceptible to these stressors that will come at you, because that's what happens in this profession. You are stressed because of the work you have. Not only that, but you have the same type of stress everybody else has. So you're compounding that.
We have just a few minutes left, and I'd like to close by asking each of you, if you had the ability to wave a magic wand right now and change one thing that would have the biggest impact on addressing the issue of PTSD among police, fire, emergency first responders, what would that one thing be? Bob?
Well, I wish. I mean, my hope would be that people would not be resistant to seeking help. That is the big thing. The big problem that I see is people feel like they're okay, they can deal with these things on their own. When there's help readily available, I just wish they'd be more open to receiving that help.
Alan?
I think if I could wish it, I'd say every department in the country should have a post-trauma group that can meet and has full confidentiality, where cops can talk amongst themselves and share stories and tell how they got help. And can I just add one more thing?
Sure.
For people who are listening, go to the American Psychological Association website. They have a whole section where you can fill out a post-traumatic growth inventory. They also have a lot about resiliency techniques and how you can develop them in yourself.
And Dee, you get the magic wand last. What would you like to change?
Oh, I want that magic wand. if I could wave it, it would be that this particular diagnosis, post-traumatic stress disorder, could come out of the closet and out of the dark ages as something to be ashamed of and hidden. And as Alan and Bob have both referred to, be something that's just you know, known to be a possible occupational risk, but also a diagnosis that can really be treated. You know, we're seeing so many people get so much better. And my magic wand would make this diagnosis much more hopeful than I think it is often understood to be.
That's all the time we have for the show today. Alan Cates is the author of Cop Shock, Surviving Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder. Alan, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Dee Paddock is a licensed mental health counselor from Des Moines. Dee, thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
And Bob Monserrat is with the State of Iowa and the Federal Disaster Mortuary Operational Response Team. Bob, thank you for your insights as well.
You're most welcome.
The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins, Jeff Schmidt, Alex Hoyer, and Lindsay Moon. Production assistance today from Rosalind Sixby. We've had technical support from Dennis Reese and John Pemble in Des Moines. Podcasting and on-demand audio of The Exchange available at iowapublicradio.org. You can give us a comment anytime, not just during the show. Send us an email at theexchange@iowapublicradio.org or send us a tweet at IPRTalk. Go ahead and follow us on Twitter as well. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Jonathan All in for Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.